Section 3. Branches of English industry without legal limits to exploitation. We have hitherto considered the tendency to the extension of the working day, the werewolf's hunger for surplus labour, in a department where the monstrous exactions, not surpassed, says an English bourgeois economist, by the cruelties of the Spaniards to the American redskins, caused capital at last to be bound by the chains of legal regulations. Footnote: the cupidity of millowners whose cruelty in the pursuit of gain have hardly been exceeded by those perpetrated by the Spaniards on the conquest of America in the pursuit of gold. John Wade, History of the Middle and Working Classes, 3rd edition, London, 1835. The theoretical part of this book, a kind of handbook of political economy, is, considering the time of its publication, original in some parts, for example, on commercial crises. The historical part is, to a great extent, a shameless plagiarism of Sir F. M. Eden's The State of the Poor, London, 1797. End of footnote. Now, let us cast a glance at certain branches of production in which the exploitation of labour is either free from fetters to this day, or was so yesterday. Mr. Broughton Charlton, County Magistrate, declared as chairman of a meeting held at the Assembly Rooms, Nottingham, on the 14th of January, 1860, that there was an amount of privation and suffering among that portion of the population connected with the lace trade, unknown in other parts of the kingdom, indeed in the civilized world. Children of 9 or 10 years are dragged from their squalid beds at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning, and compelled to work for a bare subsistence until 10, 11, or 12 at night, their limbs wearing away, their frames dwindling, their faces whitening, and their humanity absolutely sinking into a stone-like torpor, utterly horrible to contemplate. We are not surprised that Mr. Mallet, or any other manufacturer, should stand forward and protest against discussion. The system, as the Reverend Montagu Valpy describes it, is one of unmitigated slavery, socially, physically, morally, and spiritually. What can be thought of a town which holds a public meeting to petition that the period of labour for men shall be diminished to 18 hours a day? We declaim against the Virginian and Carolinian cotton planters. Is their black market, their lash, and their barter of human flesh more detestable than this slow sacrifice of humanity, which takes place in order that veils and collars may be fabricated for the benefit of capitalists? Footnote. Daily Telegraph, 17th of January, 1860. End of footnote. The potteries of Staffordshire have, during the last 22 years, been the subject of 3 parliamentary inquiries. The result is embodied in Mr. Scriven's report of 1841 to the Children's Employment Commissioners, in the report of Dr. Greenhow of 1860, published by order of the Medical Officer of the Privy Council, Public Health, 3rd Report, lastly, in the report of Mr. Long of 1862, in the 1st report of the Children's Employment Commission of the 13th of June, 1863. For my purpose, it is enough to take from the reports of 1860 and 1863 some depositions of the exploited children themselves. From the children we may form an opinion as to the adults, especially the girls and women, and that in a branch of industry by the side of which cotton spinning appears an agreeable and healthful occupation. William Wood, 9 years old, was 7 years and 10 months when he began to work. He ran moulds, carried ready-moulded articles into the drying-room, afterwards bringing back the empty mould, from the beginning. He came to work every day in the week at 6 a.m. and left off about 9 p.m. I work 9 o'clock at night 6 days in the week. I've done so 7 or 8 weeks. 15 hours of labour for a child 7 years old. J. Murray, 12 years of age, says, I turn jigger and run moulds. I come at 6. Sometimes I come at 4. I worked all night last night till 6 o'clock this morning. I have not been in bed since the night before last. There were 8 or 9 other boys working last night. All but one have come this morning. I get 3 shillings and 6p. I do not get any more for working at night. I worked 2 nights last week. Ferniho, a boy of 10, I have not always an hour for dinner. I have only 1/2 hour sometimes, on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Dr. Greenhouse states that the average duration of life in the pottery districts of Stoke-on-Trent and Woolstanton is extraordinarily short. Although in the district of Stoke only 36.6% and in Woolstanton only 30.4% of the adult male population above 20 are employed in the potteries, among the men of that age in the first district more than 1/2, in the second nearly 2/5 of the whole deaths are the result of pulmonary diseases among potters. Dr. Boothroyd, a medical practitioner at Hanley, says, "Each successive generation of potters is more dwarfed and less robust than the preceding one." In like manner, another doctor, Mr. McBean, "Since he began to practice among the potters 25 years ago, he had observed a marked degeneration, especially shown in diminution of stature and breadth." These statements are taken from the report of Dr. Greenhow in 1860. From the report of the commissioners in 1863, the following. Dr. J. T. Arledge, senior physician of the North Staffordshire Infirmary, says, "The potters as a class, both men and women, represent a degenerated population, both physically and morally. They are, as a rule, stunted in growth, ill-shaped, and frequently ill-formed in the chest. They become prematurely old, and are certainly short-lived. They are phlegmatic and bloodless, and exhibit their debility of constitution by obstinate attacks of dyspepsia, and disorders of the liver and kidneys, and by rheumatism. But of all diseases, they are especially prone to chest disease, to pneumonia, phthisis, bronchitis, and asthma. One form would appear peculiar to them, and is known as potter's asthma, or potter's consumption. Scrofula, attacking the glands or bones or other parts of the body, is a disease of 2/3 or more of the potters. That the degenerescence of the population of this district is not even greater than it is due to the constant recruiting from the adjacent country, and intermarriages with more healthy races. Mr. Charles Parsons, late house surgeon of the same institution, writes in a letter to Commissioner Long, amongst other things, "I can only speak from personal observation and not from statistical data, but I do not hesitate to assert that my indignation has been aroused again and again at the sight of poor children whose health has been sacrificed to gratify the avarice of either parents or employers." He enumerates the causes of the diseases of the potters, and sums them up in the phrase, "long hours." The report of the commission trusts that "a manufacture which has assumed so prominent a place in the whole world will not long be subject to the remark that its great success is accompanied with the physical deterioration, widespread bodily suffering, and early death of the workpeople by whose labour and skill such great results have been achieved. And all that holds of the potteries in England is true of those in Scotland." The manufacture of lucifer matches dates from 1833, from the discovery of the method of applying phosphorus to the match itself. Since 1845, this manufacture has rapidly developed in England, and has extended especially amongst the thickly populated parts of London, as well as in Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, Bristol, Norwich, Newcastle, and Glasgow. With it has spread the form of lockjaw, which a Vienna physician in 1845 discovered to be a disease peculiar to Lucifer matchmakers. Half the workers are children under 13 and young persons under 18. The manufacture is, on account of its unhealthiness and unpleasantness, in such bad odour that only the most miserable part of the labouring class, half-starved widows and so forth, deliver up their children to it. The ragged, half-starved, untaught children. Of the witnesses that Commissioner White examined, 1863, 270 were under 18, 50 under 10, 10 only 8, and 5 only 6 years old. A range of the working day from 12 to 14 or 15 hours, night labour, irregular meal times, meals for the most part taken in the very workrooms that are pestilent with phosphorus. Dante would have found the worst horrors of his Inferno surpassed in this manufacture. In the manufacture of paper hangings, the coarser sorts are printed by machine, the finer by hand. The most active business months are from the beginning of October to the end of April. During this time the work goes on fast and furious, without intermission, from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., or further into the night. J. Leach deposes, "Last winter, 6 out of 19 girls were away from ill health at one time from overwork. I have to bawl at them to keep them awake." W. Duffy, "I have seen when the children could none of them keep their eyes open for the work. Indeed, none of us could." J. Lightbourne, "Am 13. We worked last winter till 9, evening, and the winter before till 10. I used to cry with sore feet every night last winter." G. Apston, "That boy of mine, when he was 7 years old, I used to carry him on my back to and fro through the snow, and he used to have 16 hours a day. I have often knelt down to feed him as he stood by the machine, for he could not leave it or stop." Smith, the managing partner of a Manchester factory, "We," he means his hands who work for us, "work on with no stoppage for meals, so that day's work of 10.5 hours is finished by 4:30 p.m., and all after that is overtime." Footnote. This is not to be taken in the same sense as our surplus labour time. These gentlemen consider 10.5 hours of labour as the normal working day, which includes, of course, the normal surplus labour. After this begins overtime, which is paid a little better. It will be seen later that the labour expended during the so-called normal day is paid below its value, so that the overtime is simply a capitalist trick in order to extort more surplus labour, which it would still be, even if the labour power expended during the normal working day were properly paid. End of footnote. Does this Mr. Smith take no meals himself during 10.5 hours? "We," this same Smith, "seldom leave off working before 6 p.m. He means leave off the consumption of our labour power machines. "So that we, iterum Crispinus, are really working overtime the whole year round. For all these, children and adults alike, 152 children and young persons and 140 adults, the average work for the last 18 months has been at the very least 7 days 5 hours, or 78 half-hours a week. For the 6 weeks ending May the 2nd this year, 1862, the average was higher, 8 days, or 84 hours a week." Still, this same Mr. Smith, who is so extremely devoted to the pluralis majestatis, the royal we, that is, speaking on behalf of his subjects, adds with a smile, "The machine work is not great." So the employers in the block printing say, "Hand labour is more healthy than machine work." On the whole, manufacturers declare with indignation against the proposal to stop the machines, at least during meal times. "A clause," says Mr. Otley, manager of a wallpaper factory in the borough, "which allowed work between, say, 6 a.m. and 9 p.m., would suit us very well, but the factory hours, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m, are not suitable. Our machine is always stopped for dinner. What generosity! There is no waste of paper and colour to speak of. But, he adds sympathetically, I can understand the loss of time not being liked. The report of the Commission opines with naivety that the fear of some leading firms of losing time, that is, the time for appropriating the labour of others and thence losing profit, is not a sufficient reason for allowing children under 13 and young persons under 18 working 12 to 16 hours per day to lose their dinner, nor for giving it to them as coal and water are supplied to the steam engine, soap to wool, oil to the wheel, as merely auxiliary material to the instruments of labour during the process of production itself. No branch of industry in England, we do not take into account the making of bread by machinery recently introduced, has preserved up to the present day a method of production so archaic, so, as we see from the poets of the Roman Empire, pre-Christian, as baking. But capital, as was said earlier, is at first indifferent as to the technical character of the labour process. It begins by taking it just as it finds it. The incredible adulteration of bread, especially in London, was first revealed by the House of Commons Committee on the Adulteration of Articles of Food, 1855-56, and Dr. Hassell's work, Adulterations Detected. Footnote: alum, finely powdered or mixed with salt, is a normal article of commerce bearing the significant name of baker's stuff. End of footnote. The consequence of these revelations was the Act of August 6, 1860, for preventing the adulteration of articles of food and drink, an inoperative law, as it naturally shows the tenderest consideration for every free trader who determines by the buying or selling of adulterated commodities to turn an honest penny. Footnote: soot is a well-known and very energetic form of carbon, and forms a manure that capitalistic chimney sweeps sell to English farmers. Now, in 1862, the British juryman had in a lawsuit to decide whether soot, with which, unknown to the buyer, 90% of dust and sand are mixed, is genuine soot in the commercial sense, or adulterated soot in the legal sense. The Amis du Commerce, Friends of Commerce, decided it to be genuine commercial soot, and non-suited the plaintiff farmer, who had in addition to pay the costs of the suit. End of footnote. The committee itself formulated, more or less naively, its conviction that free trade meant essentially trade with adulterated, or, as the English ingeniously put it, sophisticated goods. In fact, this kind of sophistry knows better than Protagoras how to make white black and black white, and better than the Eleatics how to demonstrate ad oculos, before your own eyes, that everything is only appearance. Footnote: the French chemist Chevalier, in his treatise on the sophistications of commodities, enumerates for many of the 600 or more articles which he passes in review 10, 20, 30 different methods of adulteration. He adds that he does not know all the methods, and does not mention all that he knows. He gives 6 kinds of adulteration of sugar, 9 of olive oil, 10 of butter, 12 of salt, 19 of milk, 20 of bread, 23 of brandy, 24 of meal, 28 of chocolate, 30 of wine, 32 of coffee, etc. Even God Almighty does not escape this fate. See Rouart de Cars on the Falsifications of the Materials of the Sacrament, De la Falsification des Substances Sacramentelles, Paris, 1856, end of footnote. At all events, the committee had directed the attention of the public to its daily bread, and therefore to the baking trade. At the same time, in public meetings and in petitions to Parliament, rose the cry of the London journeymen bakers, against their overwork, etc. The cry was so urgent that Mr. H. S. Tremenhere, also a member of the Commission of 1863, several times mentioned, was appointed Royal Commissioner of Inquiry. His report, together with the evidence given, roused not the heart of the public, but its stomach. Englishmen, always well up in the Bible, knew well enough that man, unless by elective grace a capitalist or landlord or sinecurist, is commanded to eat his bread in the sweat of his brow. But they did not know that he had to eat daily in his bread a certain quantity of human perspiration mixed with the discharge of abscesses, cobwebs, dead black beetles, and putrid German yeast, without counting alum, sand, and other agreeable mineral ingredients. Without any regard to His Holiness Free Trade, the free baking trade was therefore placed under the supervision of the state inspectors. Close of the parliamentary session of 1863, and by the same Act of Parliament, work from 9 in the evening to 5 in the morning was forbidden for journeymen bakers under 18. The last clause speaks volumes as to the overwork in this old-fashioned, homely line of business. The work of a London journeyman baker begins, as a rule, at about 11 at night. At that hour he makes the dough, a laborious process which lasts from 1/2 hour to 3/4 hour, according to the size of the batch or the labour bestowed upon it. He then lies down upon the kneading board, which is also the covering of the trough in which the dough is made, and with a sack under him and another rolled up as a pillow, he sleeps for about a couple of hours. He is then engaged in a rapid and continuous labour for about 5 hours, throwing out the dough, scaling it off, moulding it, putting it into the oven, preparing and baking rolls and fancy bread, taking the batch bread out of the oven and up into the shop, etc., etc. The temperature of a bakehouse ranges from about 75 to upwards of 90 degrees, and in the smaller bakehouses approximates usually to the higher rather than to the lower degree of heat. When the business of making the bread, rolls, etc., is over, that of its distribution begins, and a considerable proportion of the journeymen in the trade, after working hard in the manner described during the night, are upon their legs for many hours during the day, carrying baskets or wheeling handcarts, and sometimes again in the bakehouse, leaving off work at various hours between 1 and 6 p.m. according to the season of the year, or the amount and nature of their master's business, while others are again engaged in the bakehouse in bringing out more batches until late in the afternoon. During what is called the London season, the operatives belonging to the full-priced bakers at the west end of town generally begin work at 11 p.m., and are engaged in making the bread, with one or two short, sometimes very short, intervals of rest, up to 8 o'clock the next morning. They are then engaged all day long, up to 4, 5, 6, and as late as 7 o'clock in the evening, carrying out bread, or sometimes in the afternoon in the bakehouse again, assisting in the biscuit baking. They may have, after they have done their work, sometimes 5 or 6, sometimes only 4 or 5, hours sleep before they begin again. On Fridays, they always begin sooner, some about 10 o'clock, and continue in some cases at work, either in making or delivering the bread, up to 8 p.m. on Saturday night, but more generally up to 4 or 5 o'clock Sunday morning. On Sundays, the men must attend 2 or 3 times during the day for an hour or two to make preparations for the next day's bread. The men employed by the underselling masters, who sell their bread under the full price, and who, as already pointed out, comprise 3/4 of the London bakers, have not only to work on the average longer hours, but their work is almost entirely confined to the bakehouse. The underselling masters generally sell their bread in the shop. If they send it out, which is not common, Except as supplying chandlers' shops, they usually employ other hands for that purpose. It is not their practice to deliver bread from house to house. Towards the end of the week, the men begin on Thursday night at 10 o'clock and continue on, with only slight intermission, until late on Saturday evening. Even the bourgeois intellect understands the position of the underselling masters. Quote, "The unpaid labour of the men was made the source whereby the competition was carried on," unquote. Footnote. George Read, The History of Baking, London, 1848, end of footnote. And the full-priced baker denounces his underselling competitors to the Commission of Inquiry as thieves of foreign labour and adulterers. Quote, "They only exist now by first defrauding the public and next getting 18 hours' work out of their men for 12 hours' wages," unquote. Footnote. Report, first, etc., evidence of the full-priced baker Cheeseman. End of footnote. The adulteration of bread, and the formation of a class of bakers that sells the bread below the full price, date from the beginning of the 18th century, from the time when the corporate character of the trade was lost, and the capitalist, in the form of the miller or flour factor, rises behind the nominal master baker. Footnote. George Read. At the end of the 17th and the beginning of the 18th centuries, the factors, agents, that crowded into every possible trade were still denounced as public nuisances. Thus the grand jury at the quarter session of the Justices of the Peace for the County of Somerset addressed a presentment to the lower house, which, among other things, states that these factors of Blackwell Hall are a public nuisance and prejudice to the clothing trade, and ought to be put down as a nuisance. The Case of Our English Wool, etc., London, 1685. End of footnote. Thus was laid the foundation of capitalistic production in this trade, of the unlimited extension of the working day and of night labour, although the latter only since 1824 gained a serious footing, even in London. After what has just been said, it will be understood that the report of the Commission classes journeymen bakers among the short-lived labourers, who, having by good luck escaped the normal decimation of the children of the working class, rarely reach the age of 42. Nevertheless, the baking trade is always overwhelmed with applicants. The sources of the supply of these labour powers to London are Scotland, the western agricultural districts of England, and Germany. In the years 1858 to 60, the journeymen bakers in Ireland organised at their own expense great meetings to agitate against night and Sunday work. The public, for example, at the Dublin meeting in May 1860, took their part with Irish warmth. As a result of this movement, day labour alone was successfully established in Wexford, Kilkenny, Clonmel, Waterford, etc. Quote, "In Limerick, where the grievances of the journeymen are demonstrated to be excessive, the movement has been defeated by the opposition of the master bakers, the miller bakers being the greatest opponents. The example of Limerick led to a retrogression in Ennis and Tipperary. In Cork, where the strongest possible demonstration of feeling took place, the masters, by exercising their power of turning the men out of employment, have defeated the movement. In Dublin, the master bakers have offered the most determined opposition to the movement, and by discountenancing as much as possible the journeymen promoting it, have succeeded in leading the men into acquiescence in Sunday work and night work, contrary to the convictions of the men." Unquote. Footnote. Report of Committee on the Baking Trade in Ireland for 1861. End of footnote. The committee of the English government, which government in Ireland is armed to the teeth and generally knows how to show it, remonstrates in mild, though funereal tones with the implacable master bakers of Dublin, Limerick, Cork, etc. "The committee believes that the hours of labour are limited by natural laws, which cannot be violated with impunity, that for master bakers to induce their workmen, by the fear of losing employment, to violate their religious convictions and their better feelings, to disobey the laws of the land, and to disregard public opinion, this all refers to Sunday labour, is calculated to provoke ill feeling between workmen and masters, and affords an example dangerous to religion, morality, and social order. The committee believe that any constant work, beyond 12 hours a day, encroaches on the domestic and private life of the working man, and so leads to disastrous moral results, interfering with each man's home and the discharge of his family duties as a son, a brother, a husband, a father. That work beyond 12 hours has a tendency to undermine the health of the working man, and so leads to premature old age and death, to the great injury of families of working men, thus deprived of the care and support of the head of the family when most required. So far, we have dealt with Ireland. On the other side of the Channel, in Scotland, the agricultural labourer, the ploughman, protests against his 13 to 14 hours work in the most inclement climate, with 4 hours additional work on Sunday. In this land of Sabbatarians. Footnote. Public meeting of agricultural labourers at Lasswade, near Edinburgh, January 5, 1866. See Workman's Advocate, January 13, 1866. The formation, since the close of 1865, of a trades union among the agricultural labourers, at first in Scotland, is a historic event. In one of the most oppressed agricultural districts of England, Buckinghamshire, the labourers in March 1867 made a great strike for the raising of their weekly wage from 9 to 10 shillings to 12 shillings. It will be seen from the preceding passage that the movement of the English agricultural proletariat, entirely crushed since the suppression of its violent manifestations after 1830, and especially since the introduction of the new poor laws, begins again in the 60s, until it becomes finally epoch-making in 1872. I return to this in the second volume, as well as to the blue books that have appeared since 1867 on the position of the English land labourers. Addendum to the third edition. End of footnote. Whilst, at the same time, three railway men are standing before a London coroner's jury, a guard, an engine driver, a signalman. A tremendous railway accident has hurried hundreds of passengers into another world. The negligence of the employee is the cause of the misfortune. They declare with one voice before the jury that 10 or 12 years before, their labour only lasted 8 hours a day. During the last 5 or 6 years, it had been screwed up to 14, 18, and 20 hours, and under a specially severe pressure of holiday-makers, at times of excursion trains, it often lasted for 40 or 50 hours without a break. They were ordinary men, not cyclops. At a certain point, their labour power failed. Torpor seized them. Their brain ceased to think, their eyes to see. The thoroughly respectable British jurymen answered by a verdict that sent them to the next assizes on a charge of manslaughter, and, in a gentle rider to their verdict, expressed the pious hope that the capitalistic magnates of the railways would, in future, be more extravagant in the purchase of a sufficient quantity of labour power, and more abstemious, more self-denying, more thrifty, in the draining of paid labour power. Footnote. Reynolds Newspaper, January 1866. Every week this same paper has, under the sensational headings, Fearful and Fatal Accidents, Appalling Tragedies, etc., a whole list of fresh railway catastrophes. On these, an employee on the North Staffordshire line comments, "Everyone knows the consequences that may occur if the driver and fireman of a locomotive engine are not continually on the lookout. How can that be expected from a man who has been at work for 29 or 30 hours, exposed to the weather and without rest. The following is an example which is of very frequent occurrence. One fireman commenced work on the Monday morning at a very early hour. When he had finished what is called a day's work, he had been on duty 14 hours 50 minutes. Before he had time to get his tea, he was again called on for duty. The next time he finished, he had been on duty 14 hours 25 minutes, making a total of 29 hours 15 minutes without intermission. The rest of the week's work was made up as follows. Wednesday, 15 hours. Thursday, 15 hours 35 minutes. Friday, 14.5 hours. Saturday, 14 hours 10 minutes, making a total for the week of 88 hours 30 minutes. Now, sir, fancy his astonishment on being paid 6 1/4 days for the whole. Thinking it was a mistake, he applied to the timekeeper and inquired what they considered a day's work, and was told 13 hours for a goods man, that is, 78 hours. He then asked for what he had made over and above the 78 hours per week, but was refused. However, he was at last told they would give him another quarter, that is, 10 pence. 1866. End of footnote. From the motley crowd of labourers of all callings, ages, sexes, that press on us more busily than the souls of the slain on Ulysses, on whom, without referring to the blue books under their arms, we see at a glance the mark of overwork, let us take two more figures, whose striking contrast proves that before capital all men are alike. A milliner and a blacksmith. In the last week of June, 1863, all the London daily papers published a paragraph with the sensational heading, Death from Simple Overwork. It dealt with the death of the milliner Mary Ann Walkley, 20 years of age, employed in a highly respectable dressmaking establishment, exploited by a lady with the pleasant name of Elise. The old, often-told story was once more recounted. This girl worked, on an average, 16.5 hours, during the season often 30 hours, without a break, whilst her failing labour power was revived by occasional supplies of sherry, port or coffee. It was just now the height of the season. It was necessary to conjure up, in the twinkling of an eye, the gorgeous dresses for the noble ladies bidden to the ball in honour of the newly imported Princess of Wales. Mary Ann Walkley had worked without intermission for 26.5 hours, with 60 other girls, 30 in one room, that only afforded 1/3 of the cubic feet of air required for them. At night they slept in pairs, in one of the stifling holes into which the bedroom was divided by partitions of board. Footnote. Dr. Leithby, consulting physician of the Board of Health, declared, "The minimum of air for each adult ought to be in a sleeping room 300, and in a dwelling room 500 cubic feet." Dr. Richardson, senior physician to one of the London hospitals, "With needlewomen of all kinds, including milliners, dressmakers, and ordinary seamstresses, there are three miseries: overwork, deficient air, and either deficient food or deficient digestion. Needlework, in the main, is infinitely better adapted to women than to men, but the mischiefs of the trade, in the metropolis especially, are that it is monopolized by some 26 capitalists, who, under the advantages that spring from capital, can bring in capital to force economy out of labor. This power tells throughout the whole class. If a dressmaker can get a little circle of customers, such is the competition that in her home she must work to the death to hold together, and this same overwork she must of necessity inflict on any who may assist her. If she fail, or do not try independently, she must join an establishment where her labour is not less, but where her money is safe. Placed thus, she becomes a mere slave, tossed about with the variations of society. Now at home, in one room, starving or near to it, then engaged 15, 16, aye, even 18 hours out of the 24 in an air that is scarcely tolerable, and on food which, even if it be good, cannot be digested in the absence of pure air. On these victims, consumption, which is purely a disease of bad air, feeds. Dr. Richardson, Work and Overwork, in Social Science Review, 1863. End of footnote. And this was one of the best millinery establishments in London. Mary Ann Walkley fell ill on the Friday, died on Sunday, without, to the astonishment of Madame Elise, having previously completed the work in hand. The doctor, Mr. Keyes, called too late to the deathbed, duly bore witness before the coroner's jury that Mary Ann Walkley had died from long hours of work in an overcrowded workroom and a too small and badly ventilated bedroom. In order to give the doctor a lesson in good manners, the coroner's jury thereupon brought in a verdict that the deceased had died of apoplexy, but there was reason to fear that her death had been accelerated by overwork in an overcrowded workroom, etc. "Our white slaves," cried the Morning Star, the organ of the free traders Cobden and Bright, "our white slaves, who are toiled into the grave, for the most part silently pine and die." Footnote. Morning Star, 23rd of June, 1863. The Times made use of the circumstance to defend the American slave owners against Bright, etc. "Very many of us think," says a leader of July the 2nd, 1863, "that while we work our own young women to death using the scourge of starvation, instead of the crack of the whip, as the instrument of compulsion, we have scarcely a right to hound on fire and slaughter against families who were born slave owners, and who, at least, feed their slaves well and work them lightly." In the same manner, the Standard, a Tory organ, fell foul of the Reverend Newman Hall. "He excommunicated the slave owners, but prays with the fine folk who, without remorse, make the omnibus drivers and conductors of London, etc., work 16 hours a day for the wages of a dog." Finally spake the oracle Thomas Carlyle, of whom I wrote in 1850, "In the cult of genius, the cult remains." Paraphrasing Schiller in a short parable, he reduces the one great event of contemporary history, the American Civil War, to this level, that the Peter of the North wants to break the head of the Paul of the South with all his might, because the Peter of the North hires his labour by day, and the Paul of the South hires his by the life. Macmillan's Magazine, Ilias Americana in Nutque, August 1863. Thus the bubble of Tory sympathy for the urban workers, by no means for the rural, has burst at last. The sum of all is slavery. End of footnote. Quote, "It is not in dressmakers' rooms that working to death is the order of the day, but in a thousand other places. In every place, I had almost said, where a thriving business has to be done. We will take the blacksmith as a type. If the poets were true, there is no man so hearty, so merry as the blacksmith. He rises early and strikes his sparks before the sun. He eats and drinks and sleeps as no other man. Working in moderation, he is, in fact, in one of the best of human positions, physically speaking. But we follow him into the city or town, and we see the stress of work on that strong man, and what then is his position in the death rate of his country? In Marylebone, blacksmiths die at the rate of 31 per thousand per annum, or 11 above the mean of the male adults of the country in its entirety. The occupation, instinctive almost as a portion of human art, unobjectionable as a branch of human industry, is made by mere excess of work, the destroyer of man. He can strike so many blows per day, walk so many steps, breathe so many breaths, produce so much work, and live an average, say, of 50 years. He is made to strike so many more blows, to walk so many more steps, to breathe so many more breaths per day, and to increase altogether a fourth of his life. He meets the effort. The result is that producing for a limited time a fourth more work, he dies at 37 for 50. Unquote. Footnote. Dr. Richardson. End of footnote.